they're very focused on the fact that they're going to win this, but they also acknowledge, you know, look, part of the problem is they're fighting their own relatives. This is a genuine civil war because the Ukrainians are Slavs, and they were, and the intermarriage that goes on between Slavs and Russians is quite extensive.
What did you learn from any of your commentary with the Russians in that? Are they frustrated that they're not going in bigger and harder? And they would like to say, we could get this war over with a lot faster, but we're being kept going slow. I know that the claim is to keep the friendly casualties low, but a lot of them say, no, we should be cut loose. How did you see any of that?
Yeah, this is the call of the generals. This is not Putin. You know, those are claiming that there's all this animus towards Putin and they want to get rid of him. No, that's a very small group. It's not the majority of the population. But the ones calling the shots on the military strategy, that's the general staff. That's Gerasimov and the generals that surround him. So, and I talked, so I sat at TASS headquarters there, just north of the Kremlin. And I spoke with 28 different people, at least four members of the Russian legislature, the Duma, one of them being the number two guy in the Duma. I spoke with four different, actually, well-known military analysts that appear frequently on Russian television and sometimes in the West, including Dmitry Orlov was one. This notion that there's great frustration with Putin over not moving fast enough, it's just, you know, sorry, that is a minority view. I know people like Gilbert Doctorow have advanced that, but I didn't hear that at all. And look, I even met with the head of the Russian Communist Party, Zhuganov. Mm. He's a character, but you know, he's an opposition party to Putin, but he supports Putin on the war, as well as his press spokesman. I spoke to him as well. So I said, this was not a group that was put together, especially to fool Larry Johnson. And I was never told, oh, don't talk about this or don't ask about that. I could ask anything I wanted. I could bring up any topic I wanted. Now, I wasn't trying to be a jerk. I recognized I was a guest in their country and I was going to be polite and ask reasonable questions, but I wasn't in a position where I had to, you know, kowtow to the and yeah. say, oh, don't go there. Don't talk about that. It was and the diversity of the group. It was a diverse group. I bet if I put them all in a room, they would have argued with each other. So guess what? It's not an authoritarian society that limits discussion.
That's interesting. And I want to ask a question based on this plurality of different folks that you talk to here. Because what we have basically on the surface is that Russia and repeated by Putin and Lavrov even just within the last few weeks, that they desire a negotiated settlement. They desire to have a diplomatic end to this that they can live with, or they're going to continue to fighting on the ground. I was on our show earlier today. I interviewed Alistair Crook, and I asked him a pretty tough point blank question. And I want to show you what I ask him here and then get your response to the same question. Here's what he said. Given the history that you just talked about, I mean, let's run from MI6, CIA, going all the way back to 47, 40, 48, et cetera, that seeds that were planted then. Is there, I mean, if we're just being honest, is there even a rational possibility to get to a negotiated denazification that's acceptable to Russia? Or literally, have we baked in that Russia can only have a military victory here and be satisfied?
I see no basis, as things stand, I see no basis for a negotiated settlement involving United States and Russia about Ukraine.
So that was really stark, because we'd gone back and forth with a number of different things, and you know, and we talked specifically about Putin's comment in Beijing last month, where he said, you know, it's either negotiations or military, and his assessment is, looking at the Western side, that there is no scenario that the requirement for denazification, demilitarization, and the territorial, and then the requirements for the Russian speakers living elsewhere in Ukraine, that they would agree to that. So he said, it seems to him the practical answer is that the only path will be a Russian military victory. Do they see it that way there too?
Absolutely. And Alistair's always very diplomatic in his, you know, I admire his calm, patient, and diplomatic approach to it. But the fact is, you know, I could say it the humorous way, is there are two ways that Russia would accept that kind of negotiated solution. No way and no way in hell. Okay, those are the two. It is, you know, they've made it very clear that the deal on the table right now are those five former Ukrainian oblasts that are now part of Russia constitutionally, and that Ukrainian troops pull out, and that there is an election that will deal with this Nazi problem that they have in Western Ukraine, and that NATO gets out, backs off from Russia. But the West, oh, no, we can't do that. It's got to be a ceasefire in place. And Russia goes, okay, well, we're not going to agree to that. So we're going to continue moving into Dnipropetrovsk, Sumy, Poltava, Kharkiv, and Odessa. They're going to take them back. And they're going to take Kiev. That's where this is going to end. They'll, you know, probably a year from now, they'll be sitting in Kiev. And there's nothing the West can do about it.
You know, with that, actually, that's not just a Russian position. Roger Boyce from the Times London, the Times this past Sunday, published an op-ed piece where he says, I hate to say this, but probably by the spring, I think Russia could be up to Kiev. That's what he said. That's not any of our commentary. That is somebody who's very much a pro-Ukrainian side, is just looking at the fundamentals, and they're coming to that same conclusion. All right, so if that be the case, if the Russians actually believe that too, then that means that they have to understand there's going to be a price to pay. And this most current one here is these new level of sanctions from President Trump against Lukoil and that other big giant. I can't think of it right off the top of my head. But those are something that Putin himself said, it's going to hurt, but we're going to work around it. Are they actually ready to say whatever has come so far and whatever may come later, is there a price that could be imposed on Russia that would cause him to stop short of what you just described there of going all the way to a military victory?
Let's first start with that. Those so-called sanctions that Trump and Bessin imposed, what a joke. I mean, because you read it and it says, if you do any transactions with U.S. banks and U.S. dollars, we're going to stop that. Well, Rosneft and then Lukoil, you know, the other one, they're not doing that much business in U.S. dollars. In fact, the one Russian, the privately owned one, the Luftoil, is it? They just sold out. They just sold to a company in Switzerland. So the fact of the matter is that Russian oil is being purchased by India, for example. India is paying with yuan, Chinese currency. They're not paying with dollars. And when Russia sells to China, they're not paying with dollars. They're paying with the Chinese currency that's now backed by gold. So these are just meaningless sanctions. And it goes to the heart of this claim that, Ukraine, man, we're destroying the Russian oil refineries. No, they're not destroying them by any stretch. They've damaged some, but I went around and looked at for gas lines in Moscow, and I saw John Helmer originally said, "Well, no, Larry was wrong." No, John, I'm absolutely right on this. It wasn't just in northern Moscow; it's in other parts of the country. The fact of the matter is, Russia's not experiencing a massive shortage on the gas side. On top of that, I spoke with a fellow who was the former economic minister for East Russia, Siberia, the whole thing. He's got the number one selling book on the Russian economy. and, you know, asked him about all this. And he basically said, look, the reality is we in Russia, we don't need exports in order to grow our economy. Yeah, we export oil, and it's exported to places like China and India who refine the oil over there. But we don't need that. We've got everything in our country in terms of natural resources that we can feed our people and employ our people and grow our economy internally. But we do the international trade because it's a way to have additional influence in the world. And that's why we're shifting now to the global south and away from Europe and the United States. We'd like to have relations with them, but we don't depend on that. And our economy's not held hostage to it. That's what the West doesn't get. They think, oh, yeah, man, we're going to apply that pressure. They're going to holler uncle. They do not care.
Well, on that question, is there a price that could be imposed, that whether they have it now or not, that could be so severe that Russians would say, you know what, it's just the juice ain't worth the squeeze. This is just too much. We're just going to go ahead and stop it on the current line of contact. Does that exist?
No, does not exist. If, you know, if the U.S. wants to go nuclear, all right, good luck with that. We'll find out who's got the better air defense system and who's got the capability to actually deliver the weapons to target. That's it. Beyond that, there is nothing the West can do to put pressure on Russia, because Russia, I mean, for God's sake, they don't understand. Russia's the only country in the world that's self-sufficient in terms of all natural resources. The United States is like number three on that list. You could build a wall around Russia, and it wouldn't need to import a single damn thing from any other country. It's already now building its own commercial airliners. Before, because it thought it could be part of the modern world, it was buying from Boeing or from Airbus. And then we sanctioned them, and we're not buying our airplanes anymore. They went, okay, we'll make our own, which they have done.
Yeah, how'd that work out?
So, hey, good job in Washington, man. Because instead of building a relationship with the Russians, you're driving them away.
And all these sanctions we did in the immediate aftermath of the February 2022, with the massive exodus of all the Western business and stuff in Russia, caused some near-term pain, but then just taught them that they can do their own or look elsewhere. And now then all of that leverage point are gone.
Yeah. So the, McDonald's has changed its name, and the Russian owns the old McDonald's chain. Starbucks, same thing. It's now Star something or other. So, you know, but you actually still see some Western businesses wanting to get in there because it's a market. Russia is a prosperous country now. And this notion that we're going to collapse the Russian economy, they've been there. They've got the T-shirt, 1991 to 1999. They had an economic collapse. They had a middle class that dropped dramatically. They had a loss of life where the lifespan of the average male dropped from like 63 to 56. They had widespread suicide. They've been there. They've suffered through that. They're done suffering in that regard. And that in part, they remember as being caused by the West. Instead of the West stepping in to help and say, hey, let's go with this transition, the West did everything they could to try to take advantage, to rape Russia. And that's what Putin put a stop to, which is one of the reasons there's such animus against Putin, because he stopped our own oligarchs from enriching themselves at the expense of the Russian people. So now, does Russia have some economic, you know, they've had inflation, and Nabulina, the head of the central bank, she's not a very popular person in some sectors because they don't like her policies to try to bring down inflation. But there's a significant portion of the economic class in Russia that's terrified of having the hyperinflation they did in the 1990s. So they're avoiding that. But the point of it is the United States has no pressure point over Russia where that we can make them hurt. They got
the bottom line. And I think that what you just said there is more important than some people might recognize. In our lifetimes, in our adult lifetimes, they have lived through profound cost and profound suffering. And of course, I've talked to some Russians who talked about the decades prior to that, and they had several other rounds where there were lots of trouble. They know how to suffer. They're nothing even close to suffering that level of stuff, and yet they still didn't like turn against the state and whatever else. And so I don't think that there's anything that we could do, even if there are some sanctions that can be found and manufactured that could genuinely hurt, that would cause Russia to say, okay, our national security issues aren't that important. We'll just forget about it and let the NATO stay in Ukraine. I just don't think that it even exists.
Yeah. Well, and look at our sanctions against Cuba. Cuba's still there. Look at our sanctions against Iran.
That's a good point.
The Ayatollah's still there. So, one of the guys brought this up. He's the co-founder of the International Unity Club. He says, you know, the problem with you Americans, he says, you think only in terms of zero-sum game. You gotta win and they gotta lose.
Yeah.
You never look for solutions that are a positive-sum game where everybody can win. He goes, our Russian approach is we're looking for that everybody comes out a winner approach, which is one of the reasons that Russia has been a leader within the BRICS movement, because they're not sitting there to say we're going to become the new hegemon. It's really not in their DNA. The notion that, you know, again, they float, oh, Russia's trying to create the Soviet empire. It's because they had control over the countries that are on their periphery. Gee, we don't do that here in the United States now, do we? Oh, yeah, tell that to Venezuela. I mean, frankly, we are so full of crap in this country where we delude ourselves all the time and fail to look in the mirror and take an objective assessment of who we are and how we have conducted ourselves over the last 60, 70 years.